From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. In 1992, U.S. Marshals were investigating Randy Weaver for federal firearms charges. A tragic series of events led to a shootout near Weaver's isolated Ruby Ridge cabin in North Idaho, which left Marshal William Deegan and Weaver's son Sammy dead, and then led to an 11-day standoff between Weaver's family and the FBI, and then to the death of his wife, Vicky, who was shot by an FBI sniper who was aiming at Weaver's friend, Kevin Harris. The case got widespread media attention. It led to a congressional investigation, and it spawned several tell-all books, television shows, and reenactments. But while we've heard from many of the people involved, we have never heard from the FBI agents who were on the ground during these events. That is, until now. CBS TV show FBI True takes viewers behind the scenes of some of the biggest crime scenes through the stories of FBI agents who were actually there. So joining us today to talk about Ruby Ridge are former hostage rescue team members Charlie Rasner and Dr. Jim McGee. I want to welcome both of you to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Gemma.
So you were both, as I mentioned, part of the FBI's hostage rescue team. Can you start with how you first became involved in the Ruby Ridge standoff? And Charlie, let me begin that conversation with you.
Well, we were stationed out of Quantico, Virginia. But in those days, we had these pagers before cell phones. And the pager went off. We had a 333 notice, which meant report immediately to a certain location. We would do a giant mount out of all of our equipment and fly to whatever crisis site we were being deployed to.
And Jim, what was your first contact with the Ruby Ridge case?
Just like Charlie. In fact, I think that we were literally at Quantico just another day, there at our compound.
Mm. So, Charlie, tell us what the Hoskew Rescue Team does and how it's different from the rest of the FBI.
The Hostage Rescue Team is a very elite, select organization within the FBI, which is purely tactical. I mean, it's you have people from all walks of life, but primarily you have people that have a tactical background or familiar with firearms, or you have to definitely be physically fit. And we train with other high-risk teams throughout the country, in the U.S. and, well, throughout the world, I should say. And they were deployed to hostage rescues, obviously, but also to exotic or I don't want to say bizarre, but remarkable, unfortunately, law enforcement events, which usually no one else is equipped to handle, because we have the law of posse comitatus. We can't send the military into these things because that would actually violate the law. So the FBI's Hostage Rescue Team was formed in 1983, initially in the event that there was an issue at the event at the Olympics in Los Angeles in 1984. That's what was created. And the idea being that we would not need to call the military in the event there was a hostage situation or any kind of a takeover like it had occurred in 1972 at the Olympics in Munich. And so the FBI was formed. You have to try out. There's a selection process. There's a training for new operators. It goes months and months and months. And then we train in-house. And then we train with a lot of the other elite military and law enforcement agencies throughout the world. And then when we respond to an event that usually no one else could contain or control or maintain any kind of security situation. And we would make arrests, or if it was a hostage situation, that's what we trained for constantly. But there were other missions that were like this Ruby Ridge situation, which was way up in the mountains. And I don't think anybody else could have contained miles and miles of raw wilderness the way the hostage rescue team could, not from law enforcement capacity. But that's in a nutshell. Jim, do you have anything you want to add to something like that?
Charlie, he did a good job covering, the whole genesis of the HRT. I suppose, we're looking at any high risk, worst case, final option type of mission. That usually was what would would motivate, you know, the powers to be to reach out to the HRT. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're basically the civilian equivalent of the Navy SEAL Team 6 or the Army's Delta. So you have three tier one teams within the United mm-hmm. States, and those are the three.
So, Jim, take us to when you get to the ground at Ruby Ridge. What do you remember? What happened?
Well, we flew in, and I think we were on C-130s probably, or a one C-141, one or the other. Cargo plane. And then we put down, and if I remember right, we put down in Boise. And then we're going to have to drive. So our vehicles are on the planes, our tactical vehicles, and even some of our rotor wing aircraft, you know, go on the plane with us, along with all of our gear. So once that's offloaded, we basically had some trucks there waiting for us that we offloaded all the gear into, and then started the trek, you know, up to where Ruby Ridge is located. Once we got in kind of at the bottom of the mountain or the hill where the cabin was located, we started to set up camp. And what I remember, it's Idaho, so of course we're going to be camping out in a potato field, right? and that's exactly right. So yeah, we're setting up camp in a potato field, and you know, putting up the drash tents, and just getting all of our gear in order, and then we're going to mm-hmm. wait until our first meeting. That's going to give us a little more intelligence and information on exactly, you know, what is the plan, what's next, what's the threat, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So when you got on the ground, what did you know at that point? Like, did you know, or had you heard that, had you heard of Randy Weaver before? Were you brought in after the U.S. Marshal William Deegan had been killed, along with Weaver's son, Sammy? Maybe Charlie or Jim, either of you, kind of take us through that process?
Hey, go ahead, Charlie.
Well, thank you. The FBI has a judicial responsibility, a jurisdiction, I should say, over assaulting of a federal officer. And so mm-hmm. in this case, all we really knew was that a federal marshal had been killed, murdered, basically. And that's why we were deployed there, because the FBI has primacy in these matters. So we were told that en route in the plane, basically on the flight over, basically that a deputy marshal had been shot and killed. They were basically ambushed. But no one else knew about anybody else. We didn't know about Sammy. We didn't know about anybody else being killed. Just that one of the marshals had been shot, and that we had a dangerous subject. We were told that this person was. The intelligence we had was that this person, Mr. Weaver, was a Army Special Forces and highly trained in various skills. I don't know if you recall the movie Rambo. If you watch mm-hmm. the Rambo series, it was basically this guy, Weaver, was supposed to be Rambo. Turned out, of course, that he wasn't. But this is what we were, not by our own people, but basically when we got on the ground, we got more information from others that were involved. Even with some of the surveillance that the marshals have been doing and other agencies, that this guy Weaver was a very dangerous fellow, and he had an encampment or a compound up on the top of this mountain, and he wasn't coming off. But we didn't know anything else other than, as far as the violence, was that the marshals had been pinned down for hours and Marshal Deegan had been murdered.
So, Jim, did you also know then during this 11-day standoff that, you know, Weaver's wife, Vicky, is shot during the standoff? I mean, what kind of information are you getting in these 11 days from August 21st to August 31st of 1992? Because my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the standoff happened when the U.S. Marshal Deegan was killed.
That's correct. So there wasn't a lot of information. I mean, Charlie, you know, kind of summarized what we knew about Randy Weaver. You know, Army veteran, allegedly some connection with the special forces, but nothing to verify that. We didn't know about really anybody else in the cabin per se. His wife Vicky. I mean, we knew she was there. We knew there were some children, but once we got on the ground, I mean, the first thing, of course, the first thing that they're going to try to establish is some sort of communications with the negotiators. So the negotiators have started working to establish some sort of capability to talk to Randy Weaver through what they call their throw phone or their negotiation phone. Meanwhile, you know, we're going to start to, deploy the sniper observers so they can begin to collect intelligence as well and provide some security to the location. That's it. We knew that we had a deputy United States Marshal who was up there with his team doing a reconnaissance of the Weaver cabin, trying to come up with a plan so they could arrest Randy Weaver, and they'd been compromised. And then a firefight ensued and he was killed. We had no idea that anybody else had been shot. We had no idea, when Vicky Weaver ended up being shot. We didn't even know that. There was no information about what was going on inside, because there was the communication, it was lacking between the Weaver. I mean, you can imagine putting yourself in their place. Randy Weaver's wife has been shot, during the episode before. And we don't know that. But then there's like this confusion. Why won't he talk to us? Yeah. Well, he's not going to talk to us because he's got his wife laying there on the floor dead.
Yeah.
So we didn't know that. We didn't know why he wouldn't talk. And he's not going to talk to the HRT anyway. He's going to be talking to the negotiators. So they're trying to figure that out. They're trying to coax him. They're even trying to coax her into speaking to them.
They don't know she's dead.
Yeah, she was already deceased, had been shot in the head. And so I'm sure he's thinking to himself, these guys are ruthless.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is unbelievable. I'm sure he's thinking that was done intentionally, but it wasn't. She was holding the door open when Kevin Harris and Randy Weaver were trying to flee back into the barricaded situation inside the cabin. So communication
but an FBI sniper, part of the HRT, was the person who killed Vicky Weaver. So,
right. Yeah.
So then when that's happening, is it that you, since you are not maybe part of that particular team, I don't know a different word for this, that you are not getting that communication? So is it not that, so I'm just trying to visualize this, I guess, is that even though you're there, boots on the ground, not everyone has eyes on the cabin all of the time. So therefore, you may not know what's going on all the time.
Let me back you up a little bit. Let me back her up a little bit, Jim.
Okay.
If I could. So we get there, we're in this potato field, as Jim said, and we have a big meeting. And we're told about this Mr. Weaver and how dangerous he is and how there are booby traps and shooting hides and things, and ways that he could ambush us, and that they already ambushed the federal marshals and killed Marshal Deegan. So, because of the terrain, and if you ever go up there, it's like seriously, it was literally snowing up, sleeting up near the cabin, and it was bone dry down where our base camp was. It was that's how high it was up there. So we had 13 snipers, and so we deployed 12. One guy had a bad knee from a previous mission. So what we did, because it was such a vast area to cover, and the cabin was in there, and we knew we had shooting hides, and there were places where he had carved shooting ports into the stone and stuff like that. They said, okay, we're going to deploy the snipers in two-man teams all around this area. And it was, so it would have been 6 two-man teams. And that's, it was a huge area. So my partner and I were sent to what was called the overwatch position. So I can only speak to what I know and what I saw. Okay. And so my partner and I were escorted by some of the marshals who had used that area as an observation point, because they were watching the cabin, because they were trying to catch Mr. Weaver outside unarmed so they could arrest him peacefully, but it never materialized that way. So my partner and I go way up to this, and this is the first day the snipers are deployed. Just as we're getting, because our area was the farthest and the hardest one to get to, we get to the overwatch, and we are so high that the clouds are below us, and we're just getting in position, and we start hearing radio traffic that the other snipers are getting in position, that they have been in position already and already are watching the cabin. And they talk, and just as we're setting up, my partner and I, in this overwatch position, we see a helicopter, our helicopter. It was we called it the Little Bird. It was a little blue helicopter. It had a pilot. It had enough room for two pilots, pilot and co-pilot, I should say, and then maybe one or two passengers. It was very tiny. But it was used for, it was so small you could take it apart and put it in a C-141 and fly it across the country, if that tells you anything about how small it was. So they were up there, very vulnerable. And just as we're getting in position, we hear a gunshot. And my partner and I are like, that was definitely a sniper rifle, because we shot almost every day. We knew what it sounded like. And a few seconds later, we hear another gunshot and a scream. Okay. But we're so high up, all we can see, as the clouds are moving in and out, as the wind blows, we see the buildings below, but that's about it. We don't know where the snipers are. And one of the snipers says, I shot. And we find out later that because the helicopter was up there and vulnerable, that someone, I think it was either Mr. Weaver or Kevin Harris, they were tracking the little bird, the little vulnerable helicopter with a rifle. And so the sniper thought, well, if they shoot and they hit the helicopter, the people inside are dead because it'll crash. And so the sniper shot at him in order to protect the helicopter. And then the person he shot at ran to the house. And apparently Miss Weaver opened the door to the cabin in order to let them in. And she was behind the door. And I was told this by individuals that know exactly what happened, or the sniper partner who's not with us tonight. So the sniper couldn't see her. He tracked the guy to the door that he had shot at the first time and shot again and didn't see her. The bullet grazed him apparently and hit Miss Weaver in the head. And that's where the scream was. And so that's why Vicky died on that first day. And we didn't know it. No one knew that the sniper hit her, because then it got dark and it was rainy and snowy and sleety. Mm-hmm. And the guys, so we decided, because it was so dangerous the way everybody was sort of, there was no communication or very little communication, and they were hundreds of yards apart, that it was safer to get everybody to come back down to the base camp and regroup and discuss what had happened. And that sets the stage for day one. And then going forward, we went back up the next day and we tried to close the perimeter so we could figure out just what had happened the first day. Does that make it more sense? I hope it does.
Yes, it really does. I really appreciate that explanation. So there were, and still is, a lot of controversy about the ROEs, or the rules of engagement, in this case, in this standoff. Can we just start with maybe, Jim, explaining what are ROEs?
Well, from an assaulter perspective, I mean, the rules of engagement are going to be pretty much in line with the FBI's deadly force policy. And that's what we operated pursuant to, you know, throughout all of the Ruby Ridge crisis. On the other hand, from the sniper perspective, it was a little different. And Charlie can probably articulate that better than I can.
in this situation, as I described it before the break, it was a vast area, rural. I mean, thick woods, mountains, very difficult terrain to traverse. You could literally see Canada from his cabin. We were so high up. And so it was the Idaho Panhandle. Beautiful country, but very, very isolated. So the snipers were hundreds of yards apart from each other in two-man pairs. Remember this, a deputy U.S. Marshal and four of his colleagues, I believe there were four of them, were ambushed and one was murdered just a few days before. Okay. And so we're in two-man pairs. We don't have communication with each other. We're hundreds and hundreds of yards apart from each other. And we're told this guy has firing ports, booby traps, and he's an expert marksman, and he's in the woods, and he knows every inch of it, and he's got colleagues up there. We don't know how many with him. So the situation was, okay, if we encounter someone with a gun and we get into a gunfight, and they retreat, are we allowed to engage them even though they're retreating? Because we don't want them to get into the woods and flank us because they know the terrain. Can they shoot at us? They run back in the woods because in normal law enforcement, you normally don't shoot a fleeing felon. It's controversial. So at this situation, though, we realize if they shoot at us and they get in those woods and they know them, it's their home turf, and they've already killed one marshal. What do you think they're going to do to us? So the idea was, okay, nobody gets away if they have a gun, we're not going to let them get back in those woods. Even if they're running away, we're going to have to shoot them, because if they get behind us, they'll pick us off one by one. We're in two-man pairs, hundreds of yards apart. Very dangerous situation. And I think that was the thought process that went behind the altering of the rules of engagement.
The bottom line is, with the rules of engagement, the intent was to try and make the situation, as bad as it was and as dangerous as it was, somewhat safer for the HRT operators, specifically the sniper observers who were out there on the perimeter. You know, some of the other intelligence that we had been passed to us was the Weavers, Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris and his children, you know, all the above. They frequently did what was called ready action drills. In other words, they would run from the cabin to set locations, usually rock outcroppings, with long weapons, and point outward with their guns, you know, from their cabin in the event of a trespasser coming on their property. That's kind of unusual behavior. And it's also, you know, a very dangerous situation. They also had dogs staked all the way around the cabin to sound off in case of an intruder coming onto their property. So all of this, you know, led us to believe, you know, this guy is very dangerous. Plus his relationship with the Aryan Nations, you know, up there in the panhandle of Idaho, that was also a big concern. So you add all of this together, and that's why the rules of engagement were slightly altered.
So we should note that when the standoff ended, Randy Weaver was eventually acquitted of all charges except for violating bail and missing a court date. Harris was acquitted as well. The Weavers filed a civil suit, and they settled out of court. There was also a failed attempt to indict FBI HRT sniper Lon Horiuchi for manslaughter after he shot Vicky Weaver, who died at the scene. We should say that, Charlie, you were awarded the FBI Shield of Bravery in the line of duty. Jim, you received the Medal of Valor for exceptional heroism during your time on the hostage rescue team. You are both no strangers to difficult, tense situations. So I'm curious, where does Ruby Ridge rank in both of your minds when it comes to tough cases that you worked on?
For me, Ruby Ridge, really, it was a travesty in many ways. It was a travesty in terms of what happened on the mountain. Now, I'm not going to give Vicky Weaver a pass because a United States Marshal had been murdered, and no one was ever held to answer for his death and, you know, his sacrifice, you know, for our country. And he was there in a legal capacity. So if you have individuals that are in the process of committing a felony and they are killed during that commission of the felony, guess what? The onus is on them. And when I look back on Ruby Ridge, I just am disappointed that no one was ever held culpable for the murder of Marshall Bill Deegan.
I'm curious too, and maybe Charlie, you can answer this, and Jim, you of course too. Do you believe there were mistakes made during the standoff at Ruby Ridge, and have there been? Do you think attempts to fix those mistakes, if that makes sense?
I don't think that's for us to judge. Let me just say, hindsight's 20/20 in every one of these situations. But let me go back to your earlier question about, and that Jim just did a good job of answering. No one was ever held accountable for Marshall Deegan's murder. And sadly, we come to realize, and we did not know this at the time, they lost their 12-year-old son, Sammy, apparently during the same shootout that where Marshall Deegan was murdered. So apparently he had a Mini 14. That's a very powerful rifle for a child. I found the body of Sammy Weaver along with one of my teammates. We found the body. He was in what was called the birthing shed that Miss Weaver would go to every month when she had her menstrual cycle. She left the house and lived out in this shed during that time frame every month. And so he was apparently, Sammy was in the initial shootout with Marshall Deegan. Now, Kevin Harris was also involved, apparently. And of course, Sammy was killed by return fire from the Marshals because they were fired upon, and they returned fire. They didn't know it was a 12-year-old kid with a high-powered rifle. I found a body. He was, we first thought that he was a live person. We were clearing this shed, myself and this other agent. We gave commands. The body didn't move. We went in there and we found a child who had been wrapped. He was in children's underwear, like a tidy whitey, as they call them, little kid. He was cleaned up. His arm had been shredded with a high-powered, high-capacity round. And it looked like it, the way he was hit in his arm, it looked like it hit his wrist and went all the way down his forearm and entered and exited out the back of his, where his elbow would have been, which indicates to me he was holding a rifle when he was shot. And the other round was in his back. So I assume that it's easy to say he was probably spun around by that first round, because it would do that to you. That kind of a round would do that. And so he was hit in the back, and then he probably died. Not instantly, probably suffered for quite a while. But he's cleaned up and wrapped in a white plastic sheet on this bed in this birthing house that they had near the main house. When you put your kid in that situation, I mean, no good can come of that. This whole situation is tragic. I'm very sorry for what happened to the family. We all are. No one would want that. That's not what we went there for. We didn't go there to kill people. We went there to arrest the assailant of Marshall Deegan. And essentially that's, you asked me how I feel about the situation. That's pretty much how I feel.
You know, it's been more than 30 years since Ruby Ridge. And I think this is the first time that you have both spoken publicly about the case. Why is it important now for the two of you to talk about Ruby Ridge?
Well, for me, I think that it's not something that has left the public's mind. I mean, there are still a lot of, I guess, unanswered questions. I get involved in presentations sometimes about other topics, and during the question and answer session, this many times will come up, and you can tell that there's confusion, there is a lack of knowledge as to exactly what happened, you know, up there on that mountain and who was responsible. So it's continued to fester in some people's minds. And then even within academia, you know, I teach courses where I'll talk about some of these crises that I had firsthand involvement in. And you can tell the students, especially, you know, the under 30, this all happened before they were born. They, if they've heard about it, what they've heard is generally negative with respect to the FBI and HRT's involvement. And you know, that's bothersome to me. I would like to set the record straight. So I think that's what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100% with what Jim just said. There's so much misinformation, disinformation, and has been since day one. I'll call out the NRA on this because I grew up in Texas, okay? I'm a Second Amendment proponent. I was a law enforcement officer for 31 years, but I believe in the right to keep and bear arms. I think that's an American, it's in our Constitution and should always stay in there. I'm not trying to be political here. But I'm just saying that's my background. I believe in this, and I believe they had the right to keep and bear arms. But the misinformation that came out on some of the periodicals that were came out from the American Rifleman, and at the time they did the same thing about Waco. They didn't tell the truth, and they just fanned the flame. There was a guy named Neil Knox that wrote one article after another. It was extremely inflammatory, many times untrue. Totally mischaracterized what happened. And unfortunately, people believe this stuff. And it's, and so after 30 years of remaining silent, I'd like for people to know the truth about what really happened there and know that we went up there just to make an arrest, and it went south. And the situation was way out of control when we got there, but that's exactly why we were there. And that's exactly reason they had us was for these types of situations. It's unfortunate, and it's very sad that they lost their son, they lost their mother. It's terrible. If we could change it, we would, but we didn't create the situation. We tried to go up there and stabilize it and end it peacefully, and thank God we ended up ending it peacefully, because it could have been much worse at the end, but it wasn't, thank God.
I want to thank both of you so much for taking time to talk to us and to start to set the record straight. So really appreciate your time. We've been talking with former FBI agents Charlie Rasner and Dr. Jim McGee, who were both on the hostage rescue team in the Ruby Ridge case, and they will be featured on CBS's FBI True docuseries. That will be tomorrow night, November 14th. Thank you both. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.